Hi, I'm Siri Shalazi, senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School.
And I'm Iris Bonnet, professor at Harvard Kennedy School and co-director of the Women in Public Policy program. We are the authors of the new book, Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results.
We're excited to share 5 key insights from our research and our book with you, and we hope you'll find them useful in making your own work and your organization more fair.
Here's our first insight. At some point, you probably stayed at a hotel where the room key card did not just serve the purpose of opening and closing doors, but also of turning lights on and off. As you might imagine, this little bit of technology makes it so much more likely that lights are in fact off when we leave the room than anything else we could conceivably do. This is our vision for fairness as well. We want to embed it into everything we do. For short, fairness is not a program. It is a way of doing things. But it does not happen automatically. After all, it's only a few years ago that Astrid Linder, a Swedish engineer, and her team developed the first crash test dummy built on a woman's body to make all car drivers safe. And you might recall that we all learned during COVID-19 that personal protective equipment, PPE, was not made for everyone. Not for those with small hands. Not for those with large feet. Not for those whose cultural dress code did not correspond to the standard coveralls. So unfairness can creep in everywhere. Our cars, our protective gear, artificial intelligence, the data we use to make decisions, and all the practices and procedures in our workplaces. Let me give you a concrete example. A few years ago, we were approached by one of the largest employers in Australia. They were puzzling over the following finding. When people apply to positions of leadership at this organization, they sent those who were not chosen an email inviting them to reapply. They found that men were about twice as likely to reapply than women. Why was this? And what could they do to not lose all that talent? So we worked with them and asked lots of questions. The decisive one was this: who are you writing to? They responded that they did not want to invite everyone back, but only wrote to the top 20% of the applicants. And this was our opener. Given that women have been found to be less self-confident, less sure about their relative standing, we suggested that we run an experiment, a randomized controlled trial. What we did was this: some applicants got the email that was normally sent, but for others, we added one sentence to their standard email, inviting people to reapply, sharing with them that they were among the top 20% of applicants. It turned out it completely closed the gender gap in reapplication rates. Note that this was possible without, and I'm saying this in quotation marks, fixing women. But instead, we fixed the system and equalized the playing field for all.
Our second insight is make fairness count. Roz Atkins, a TV presenter at the BBC, did exactly this when he realized he had no data on hand to know if he featured women and men equally as experts on his nightly primetime news show. So Atkins and his team decided to generate the data themselves. They began spending 2 minutes at the end of each night's show counting how many women and men had appeared on screen during their 1 hour on air. This counting exercise was highly illuminating. The team discovered that women made up only 39% of experts on air, a much lower share than they had anticipated. The counting also helped to motivate them to change their behavior. They set themselves a target of reaching 50-50 gender parity, and they became much more thoughtful about sourcing new and more diverse experts to feature on air. Within 4 months, they hit their 50-50 target, and they kept that up for years. They also inspired hundreds of other BBC content creating teams to join them in what has now become the global 50-50 The Equality Project. What we think is particularly notable about this example is that Roz Atkins and his team made fairness count in their own work, even though it wasn't an organizational mandate, even though HR wasn't feeding them data. They simply knew that to create the highest quality journalism, it needed to be representative of the world that they reported on, and they tweaked their everyday ways of working to better deliver on that goal. Another great example is Google, which discovered a few years ago that women were leaving the company at higher rates than men. A deeper dive into the data revealed that it was actually new mothers, specifically, that drove this pattern. Once the data helped Google pinpoint the problem, they tested a solution, increasing the length of leave available to all new parents from 12 to 18 weeks. And that duration has actually even been increased since then. Google continued to monitor the data, and happily they discovered that this solution in fact worked to close the gender gap. What Roz Atkins and Google teach us is that to make fairness count, we need to use exactly the same tools we rely on to manage our daily work, or our so-called core business: data, goals, incentives, and accountability. Accountability in particular is critical because research shows that it's one of the most powerful influences on behavior. For the 50-50 project, this meant that all participating teams could see each other's data on a monthly basis, so there was nowhere to hide. When we humans know that our actions are being watched, we're more likely to be on our best behavior.
Here's our third insight. In addition to making fairness count, we also need to make it stick. Raising awareness won't do. We have to build the change into the practice and procedures used. Take resume, perhaps a benign document describing our educational and work experience. But whoever decided what a resume should look like? Two of our collaborators, Ariella Crystal and Oliver Hauser and their colleagues, took this to heart and tested the impact of a redesigned resume. They were interested in one specific issue, namely how we describe work experience. So they explored the impact that different ways of framing work experience on resumes has on the likelihood that an applicant would be invited to an interview. They responded to job postings by more than 9,000 employers in the United Kingdom. And they presented candidates' job history either by the number of years a job was held or, as is commonly done, by indicating the dates during which the applicants had worked in a given job. Specifically, the revised resumes displayed a single number indicating the years worked. This might read something like this: 3 years assistant manager operations. Or they focused on the exact time frame during which this occurred. Imagine, for example, July 2015 to June 2018, assistant manager operations. Before we share with you what the researchers found, we should note that work experience is neither our favorite nor the most accurate predictor of future success. But we definitely prefer years worked over employment gaps for screening purposes. While still sharing information accurately, the change in framing made the applicant's acquired expertise salient, but obfuscated employment gaps. And it had quite a remarkable effect. When prior work experience was shown by the number of years worked, but without any dates, it increased the likelihood that a candidate would be invited to an interview by 15%. This finding held for women and men. And while this reframing is gender neutral, it will disproportionately benefit those more likely to have had career breaks: women.
Our fourth insight is make fairness normal. Flexible work is a case in point. Before the pandemic, in many organizations, flexible work was a special accommodation that was available by request only and not always granted. During COVID, many companies came around to what research has in fact shown for decades, that providing flexible work options available to everyone as a default helps to improve retention, employee satisfaction, and in many cases, also productivity. Studies in the UK and Switzerland even showed that job postings that were advertised as flexible received up to 30% more applications, especially from women. This is because employees, as well as job seekers, pay attention to companies' signals about their norms and culture. In other words, what is accepted, expected, and normal. Drivers do the same. In the state of Montana, 85% of drivers reported using seatbelts, but they estimated that only 60% of other drivers would do so. And in Saudi Arabia, married men similarly underestimated the share of other husbands who supported their wives working outside the home. While 87% of Saudi men said they themselves were supportive, they believed only 63% of their peers would be. Closing these kinds of perception gaps helps to shift what people view as normal and then what they actually end up doing, like in meetings. If your workplace has a culture of rampant interruptions in meetings, it can be hard to get the full benefit of everyone's ideas. One simple way to shift the norm is to interrupt the interrupter, like this. Hear us. I look forward to hearing what you have to say, but let's please let Nicole finish her point first. Soon, interruptions will likely become less and less common because they are no longer tolerated or viewed as normal.
Our fifth and final insight is, make fairness personal. Remember the film Hidden Figures and how you felt when you first met, in quotation marks, Katherine Johnson, Mary Jackson, and Dorothy Vaughan, three brilliant mathematicians who worked for NASA during the space race in the 1960s. These three women have inspired many. Jackson became the first female African-American engineer at NASA. Vaughan was the space agency's first African-American supervisor. And Johnson conducted crucial research on flight trajectories for various space shuttle missions that led her to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Role models matter. Seeing is believing. A few years ago, India amended its constitution with the provision that a third of village head positions had to be held by women. Seeing women in leadership changed what women in these villages thought was possible for themselves. They became politically active, spoke up in town hall meetings, and were more likely to run for political office themselves. The role models even inspired parents, who reported that one of the core career aspirations for their daughters was to become a politician. You can be one of these role models. You can also change the portraits on your office walls to make sure they represent all people. You can inspire others to dare.
So as you can see, the crux of making work fair is that it has to be part of every single person's job. No matter your role, your seniority, your activities, there is something that you personally can do to make your work more fair. We liken this to communications. Most companies have a dedicated corporate communications department that handles the most high-profile press releases and the CEO's speeches. But at the same time, every employee is writing emails, speaking in meetings, and creating slide decks on a daily basis. We hope you'll draw inspiration from people like Roz Atkins and the many others we featured in our book to become a so-called norm entrepreneur. Make small changes in the way you work and share them with others. Start to shift what people see as normal or what people expect is the way to do things. Together, we can get further faster and see real results unlike ever before.
Thank you very much for listening.
We hope you enjoy the book.